Everybody ready to proceed? All right, please proceed, Appellant.
Aloha, Chief Judge and members of the court. This is an appeal from a land court proceeding. The state, as the adjoining landowner, claimed its interest in the land, including water and its free flowage and minerals and metallic mines. The appellees opposed the state, stating that the state had lost any rights that it had possessed in the land when its predecessor in title, the Campbell Trustees, registered land in land court in 1938. The state brings this appeal to assert its interests in the property that still exists. My argument today covers 3 points. First, the appellees do not own the mineral rights in their land by virtue of their predecessor's land court application. A landowner cannot get more than it owns simply by registering it in land court. Second, the Kamehameha deed, one of the 4 deeds in question, did not convey minerals and metallic mines to Apelli's predecessor. And third, incident to the state's ownership of water is an easement for its free flowage. The Campbell trustees did not claim mineral rights in the 1938 land court proceeding. The state still owns all minerals and metallic mines.
Are mineral and metallic rights an encumbrance on the property?
Yes, they are, Your Honor.
So why can't they be waived in a land court proceeding?
Because they were never claimed. In fact, the Campbell trustees, failed to identify the territory of Hawaii's reservation of mineral and metallic mines as an encumbrance or make any attempt to claim them in the 1938 land court application.
But weren't the deeds and the land grants, weren't they part of the application?
Yes, they were. And all of the deeds, all 3 of the deeds, numbers 561, Royal Patents 5616, Royal Patent 5693, and grant number 550, they all included a reservation of minerals and metallic mines to the government.
So at that point, didn't the state owe a duty to assert and maintain its rights in the minerals?
The state owned the minerals, however, the Campbell trustees did not claim to own it in the land court proceeding, because in the land court proceeding, the application actually said, quote, it said that they do not know of any mortgage or encumbrance affecting said land or that any other person has an estate or interest therein, legal or equitable, in possession, remainder, reversion, or expectancy, except as follows. And there, the Campbell trustees listed the encumbrances that they were claiming in the land. The territory's mineral rights were not identified there. Thus, we believe that the Campbell trustees did not claim mineral rights in the 1938 land court proceeding. Additionally, because as Judge Castagnetti has pointed out, the property was described by a series of royal patents and land commission awards. The list included the 2 royal patents and grant in question, all of which contained the mineral reservation. And therefore, the decree in the land court was a mere confirmation of what was already in existence. Land court registration did not give these Campbell trustees anything more because they could not register what they did not own.
But doesn't your theory subvert the whole purpose of a land court registration? You're saying if I registered property but I neglect to include all encumbrances, then every time I subsequently saw the land, we got to go back and figure out whether the original registration had properly claimed all the encumbrances?
I do not think it subverts land court registration in that this was a manifest injustice. Everybody knew at that time that all of these original deeds included a reservation of mineral and metallic mines. That was known to everyone.
Well, if that's true, then why wouldn't the territory have waived it by not asserting it? because they were a party. It's not a case in which we're trying to extinguish an encumbrance that was not that was owned by someone who was not a party to the proceeding. Here the territory was a party to the proceeding.
Yes, and the territory did claim things like roads and I believe a school lot, but I don't think that the minerals and metallic mines were at issue at that time because it was not something that anybody was claiming because everybody knew that it was part of what the state owned. And in fact, in Minnesota is one of the very few other torrens or land registration states. In the case of Estate v. Coaster v. Hale, the Minnesota court was faced with land that had been mistakenly registered. And the landowners actually claimed ownership of this land because the time to amend the certificate of title had long passed. Well, the court held that no person holding a certificate of title to registered land ought to acquire land, title to land not intended to be purchased or conveyed and for which no consideration was paid solely on the ground that the basic purpose of the torrens registration procedure precludes a challenge to the title of lands described in the certificate of registration except in cases of lack of jurisdiction or fraud. This case represents no more than a correction of an error admittedly during the registration proceedings. To permit defendants to commit to maintain the registration of title to the disputed tract would exploit the title registration law and would accomplish a manifest injustice.
But in that case, was the party prejudiced, the party to the original registration proceeding?
The party
who's claiming, now is claiming that their interest in land was taken away, were they a party to the original proceeding?
I do not believe so, Your Honor, but I
doesn't that distinguish that case from our case?
Oh, I'm sorry, I reverse that. I don't know, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that distinguish that case from our case where the territory was a party to the proceeding?
No, Your Honor, I think that even with the territory being a party, it was the original land court that erred in giving an interest to the appellees that they never owned and never claimed.
So your theory is that if the trust Campbell trustees had identified the reservation of material metallic mines at the time of the 1938 registration, and the state had said, okay, you know what, we got disputes over some of this property, so you give us title to some, we'll give up our reservation as to the others. That would be okay?
No, because the state has never given up its title.
No, but if they did. In the registry, you're saying the problem in this case was that the trustees didn't tell the territory that you have a reservation of metallic and minerals and metallic mines on the property.
Yes.
If they had told the state that, and the state said, fine, you know what, we're willing to give that up because we have other disputes with respect to the registration, you give us something, we'll give up our reservation, would that have extinguished the reservation?
I believe so. It would have been litigated. It was never litigated here.
So it's not an inalienable right that the state has that can never be given up?
No, it is not. However, at the time, this right was a fairly new right, and it was part of what was not given up in the Mahele, as I was discussed with the Kamehameha deed, and therefore everybody knew that it was something that the sovereign, the government, retained and owned as to
right, all. Right, but when you concede it's a right that could be conveyed, relinquished, waived, given up by the state or the territory at its option?
According to statute, yes. Now, the Kamehameha deed did not transfer the sovereign's mineral rights. The fourth original title document is what's called Kamehameha deed. The deed from Kamehameha III to Charles Gordon Hopkins dated September 10, 1851, did not expressly reserve minerals or metallic mines to the government. The king, however, as an individual, was selling his personal lands, and these grants did not include mineral rights. He, in his individual capacity, could not give away anything the sovereign was not permitting to be given away at the time. To provide you with a bit of background, the land sold by the king was land that he, as a sovereign, had awarded to himself as an individual the day after the Mahele. The Mahele, or division, took place between January 27, 1848, and March 7, 1848. At that time, the king and the chiefs of Kurungiki issued quitclaim deeds to one another for land that they both individually claimed. The form of the quitclaim deed simply stated, "I hereby agree that this division is good, the lands above written belong to X." And then it was signed and affirmed.
Well, what authority do you have that the king's lands reserve mineral and metallic rights?
As the sovereign, you mean?
You're saying that the sovereign automatically has those rights?
I'm saying that during the Mahele, the sovereign retained those rights in all lands.
So the king couldn't sell it in fee simple to someone he wanted to?
The king could sell his own lands in fee simple until from the time of the Mahele to 1865, when legislation was passed precluding the king from selling or leasing or doing whatever he wanted with his lands. But prior to that, all lands that were owned by the king in his individual capacity were sold without minerals and metallic mines. Because on the day after the Mahele, the king, as a sovereign, divided his lands in two. The smaller portion, which were his individual lands, became known as crown lands, and the larger portion became known as government lands. Now, in the ensuing land transfers, there was no express intent of the king to transfer mineral rights to anyone, including himself. If you take a look at McBride, the case, it held that the king, absent the king's express intent, the Mahele did not transfer to the Konohikis the king's right to surplus water. And then if you look at the case of Kekiekie, that held that the king could not convey a greater title than he had to dispossess native tenants of their kala patches. Now the same applies to mineral rights for the following reasons. First, the intent of the king in awarding land was to encourage agriculture, solely to encourage agriculture. In the Journal of the House of Nobles, it actually quotes the king, and the translation says, "I trust that the labors of the land commissioners will result in rendering titles to land clear and fixed, and thus by a foundation for agricultural purposes, to lay a foundation for agricultural purposes, to encourage agriculture so as to increase the amount of exportable products would be a desideratum." Second, the land commission, who was tasked with awarding the majority of land, recognized that this right to award land was based on the king's private right as an individual participant and landowner, and not as a sovereign head of the nation. And by statute, all royal patents issued upon land commission awards were subject to a reservation to the government of all minerals and metallic mines of every description. Now, these two laws are reproduced at two revised laws of Hawaii at 2128 and 2191. Now, in the application of Robinson, the court recognized that these statutes were of general application and not limited to the sale of government lands. And in that case, it applied this law reserving minerals and metallic mines to land patents issued on land commissions. Moreover, the Robinson court found that the statute made the reservation of minerals and metallic mines self-effectuating. No individual received
land. So that was a case in which the state asserted that interest in the proceeding, right?
Yes, it is. However, I think that...
Doesn't that make a difference?
No, I don't think, because it was never at issue. I don't think that...
But it was an issue in the case because they asserted the interest. That's how the appeal came up.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
right? I mean, in other words, that was the issue in the appeal, whether the fact that the Land Commission award did not have a reservation, but the corresponding royal patent grant did, royal patent did, is that, do you read the two together?
Yes, but the court actually said the statute was actually regarding regarding just lands given out by the government, and they said no, it applied to all lands. So there was no reason to assume that a grant from the king included anything more, and that it included the reservation of minerals and talc mines. Appellees claim that the predecessor in title, the original grantee of the Kamehameha deed, received, quote, perfect title from the king. Perfect title does not mean that there were no encumbrances on the king's land. Perfect title just meant that the king did not need to pay the government's commutation in order to receive a allodial title to the lands that he received during the Mahele, because he had given a portion of his lands to the government on March 8th, the day after the Mahele, that was going to be called the government lands. So the land court erred when it determined that the Kamehameha deed was not subject to any mineral rights in favor of the government. Now my third point is the free flowage of water. What is the free flowage of water? The free flowage of water is an incident to the state's public trust ownership of water, and like a traditional easement, permits one to cross the land of another. The court in Rapoon recognized that all waters are part of a natural water course, whether visible or not, constituting a part of the whole body of moving water. The Robinson v. Ariyoshi court held that the public trust in water necessitates a retention of authority and imposition of a concomitant duty to maintain the purity and flow of our waters.
Well, what exactly would a recorded easement for the free flowage of water over the subject property, what would that entitle the state to do?
The free flowage of water over the property would allow the state to maintain the purity and flow of our waters and ensure its reasonable and beneficial uses.
Doesn't the state already have the authority to do that pursuant to its public trust authority?
However, the
Is that yes? Do they already inherently have that ability?
To some extent, we would like to, we are trying to ensure that the waters in their water course, natural water courses, are not deviated.
Why do you need an easement, a recorded easement, to do that?
I think we need a recorded easement to do this because to ensure that the water is in its natural water course, I think.
And under your theory, the state could similarly obtain the same easement on every single private property owned in the state?
Yes, Your Honor.
Has the state attempted to do that?
Yes, Your Honor.
In other words, have they tried to assert an easement against every property in the state?
When issues of quiet title or land court registration appear, the state does claim, and this is the language, the state claims an easement for the free flowage of waters through, over, under, and across the property.
And does it get it?
Yes, it does.
Counsel, if we were to rule in your favor, wouldn't that just sort of disrupt the whole land registration system? No one could ever take a title on its face again. Conclusiveness would be gone. We'd have to go back to the time it was registered to see what was raised, what wasn't raised, what people had in mind.
Are you talking about water or are you talking about
title? I'm talking about title.
No, Your Honor. As far as water goes, our claim to water is an incident to the state's ownership of water and the public trust. As far as minerals go, It is specific in that there was a clear error committed either during the time of registration or by the judge in the land court.
That's my point. So the title on its face is no good anymore. We have to go back to the time it's registered, see what was going on. Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, but there are arguments that say in actual times of clear error and manifest injustice, the court is able to go back in time past that 1 year when...
Right, but what's the manifest injustice in this case? The state's a party. The state's not an insignificant party with no resources. Why would that be something... You're arguing it's tantamount to fraud on the part of the trustees because they didn't specifically include the mineral and metallic mines reservation in their application. Why is that if the state or the territory was a party to the proceeding?
I don't want to say fraud, and it's that everybody knew that the state owned this, and I see that my time's up. May I conclude?
Sure.
It came back on again. I don't want to say fraud. I just want to say that the Campbell trustees never identified this, and they represented to the land court that there were no encumbrances of this form on the title to the property when they registered it.
Yeah, but isn't that the purpose of registration itself is to quiet title, clear title to the property? And so once the registration is issued, then you don't have to go back and litigate these things over again?
I think so, except the courts have said that there are instances where matters may be brought up again.
Is one of those instances when one of the parties doesn't assert its rights?
It's not that the state did not assert its right. It's that Campbell never claimed the mineral rights. The mineral rights were there. Everybody knew it was there. Everybody knew that it was part of the original land grants, and Campbell never claimed it. And therefore, it was not an issue. The territory had no reason to challenge that. Thank you, Your Honor. Is my time up?
You know, that's just a warning for your time.
Oh, okay.
The red light is the stoplight.
Okay. I thought it was only on for like a minute or so, though.
I think it's a 5-minute warning.
Oh, okay. Okay. To conclude what my definition of the free flowage water, the public trust necessitates a retention of the authority and imposition on a... I need my glasses, sorry. The public trust necessitates a retention of authority and the imposition of a concomitant duty to maintain the purity and flow of our waters for future generations and to assure that the waters of our land are put to reasonable and beneficial uses. This does not mean that a landowner cannot interfere with the natural flow as long as it is not unreasonable under the circumstances in accordance with current statutory law. And by that I'm citing Rodriguez v. State. Modern property law in Hawaii evolved from the Mahele and incorporates elements of English common law, Western law, and Hawaiian custom and usage. In the days of the kingdom, the sovereign had the right to control the free flowage of water, and in Kohakiakie, the court ordered a landowner with springs on his land to take down a flume that was diverting water from its natural water course because the reduction in the stream flow would negatively affect a lower Oahu.
Let me ask you this. Under your theory,
yes,
regardless of whether or not the easement is recorded, the state still has a right, correct? So whether the easement's recorded or not, we're not the failure to record the easement doesn't extinguish the state's water rights with respect to the property.
Yes, however, I believe that saying the state does not have an easement would turn water law on its head. It goes against cases such as Waihole, in that the court in Waihole said that the ownership of water in natural water courses and rivers remain in the people of Hawaii for their common
good. But Waihole didn't say that you have to record an easement for the free flowage of water on every property in the state.
No, Your Honor, but I think that...
And the land court in this case recognized that the state did have a public trust water right with respect to the subject property.
They were kind of... They didn't. I don't think they wanted to get...
He just said it wasn't a... The court just said it wasn't a recordable encumbrance on the title.
Yes, Your Honor. But I think that the use of water requires flowing water and the ability to control the flow of water. An incident to the state's ownership of water is the state's interest that water be allowed to flow over the lands of others and allow for the beneficial use of water, both as uses in the stream and as well as diversions from the streams and water courses.
Do you have any case that says the public trust water rights is a recordable easement?
No, Your Honor, but the Waihole Court likened the water trust to the Waihole Court likened the water trust to the riparian rights and said that said that the landowner could not take land that belonged to the state.
All right, your red light is on now, so you want to save some time for rebuttal?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Jennifer Bank representing Petitioner Appellee James Campbell Company, LLC. Thank you for the opportunity to present arguments on these issues to us this morning. Listening to the state's argument, I feel compelled to sort of reorder the argument that I had laid out on my notes because I want to respond to some of the issues that were raised and questions brought up by you. The issue of why are we here in the first place? We're here now on an appeal of a simple subdivision matter. This property, originally comprising of almost 15,000 acres, was registered by our predecessor entitled the estate of James Campbell in 1936. That registration process began, I believe, in 1934 when the application was submitted. As already discussed, the state was fully apprised of all of the proceedings. The state was served. The state served an answer. The state disputed certain interests. And when that final land court decree was issued in 1938, it absolutely bound by law.
Well, respond to the state's argument or claim that in that proceeding, your predecessors in interest did not inform the state or put in issue the question of whether they were seeking to extinguish the Mineral Metallic Mines reservation.
I will, thank you. I've got three responses to that. First response is based on statute. The second response is sort of an analysis of the application of Robinson, the case, the 1966 case that the state brought up. And the third has to do with the manifest injustice issue. Okay, first of all, statutory construction. Right now, the statute is Chapter 501. The statute is substantially the same as what was enacted in 1903 when the Torrance statute was first enacted, and there's no dispute by the parties on that. The statute says currently with respect to the decrees, and I quote, every decree of registration of absolute title shall bind the land in quiet title thereto, and it shall be conclusive upon and against all persons, including the state. What else could that possibly mean? That's it. And to further that, under Section 74, which provides the details that have to be incorporated into a land court decree, it says that the land court decree shall set forth the estate of the owner and also, in such manner as to show their relative priority, quote, all particular estates, mortgages, easements, liens, attachments, and other encumbrances. That's what was in the decree. That's what was in the decree that the state was a party to. You know, that was the final result. So I believe that statutorily, The state waived whatever claim it may have had. We, by submitting the deeds and by submitting the application, those mineral reservations were essentially up for grabs. The state failed to do it. The law is clear from 1938 forward, for more than 70 years, the state hasn't claimed this reservation.
Is there any obligation for the land court registration to be effective to extinguish encumbrances that in seeking the registration you have to identify? You know, if you fail to identify every and all encumbrance on the property, then the subsequent issuance of the registration doesn't extinguish non-disclosed encumbrances. Is there any authority to that effect?
No, Your Honor, there's not. Again, I point you to the language of what the decree says and also what the purpose of the decree is, which is to bind all persons, including the state. There are exceptions for fraud. It's actually a fairly limited exception, and again, that wasn't brought up, and even if it was brought up, we're about 72 years too late to be dealing with that issue. And if I can, I'm going to now address the application of Robinson, because in that case, if the state had done here what the state did in 1966, which was specifically plead to the land court, and I quote, if title to the land be registered to applicant, that said land be made subject to the reservation of all mineral and metallic mines of every description in the state of Hawaii. Now, the state could do that in 1966. Why couldn't it have done it in 1934? But it didn't. And the land court in that case said no. And there's complicated reasons why it said no that I won't get into unless you want me to. But at the end of the day, the state then appealed the case to court, which the state absolutely could have done in 1938, but it didn't. So Robinson merely holds that if the state doesn't waive its rights and the state seeks an appeal and the state is right on the law, then they get justice. It doesn't in any way enliven rights that the state knowingly waived. And now, if I may, I'd like to get to the issue of manifest injustice, because one of the state's cases on the estate of Koestler, which is that Minnesota case, is from 1973. I think the facts in that case are pretty important. Yes, it is true, as the state explained, that there the court looked at the facts and said there's 10 acres of land that were erroneously registered to applicant A, and that's not right. You know, he didn't really ever own that land. It was a mistake, and we have to undo it. But if I can just delve into the details there, the attorney of the applicant was also the attorney of the neighboring property owner whose land was erroneously included in the application. There was that applicant, the applicant, of course, was a party to the proceeding, but the adjacent property owner, whose attorney said, oh, by the way, adjacent property owner, my client, here's this application, you might want to take a look at it. I mean, they were served merely because they were adjacent property owners. They never participated in the proceeding. They had no reason or a way of knowing that their property was at issue, I mean, fairly. And what the court said is that the notice given those adjacent property owners was so limited and of such legal insignificance that it should not be afforded any weight. The Gills, these people who almost lost 10 acres of land, made no appearance in the land court proceedings. To permit the defendants in that case to maintain their registered title to this disputed 10-acre tract would exploit the title registration process and accomplish a manifest injustice. That's the manifest injustice, okay? That's entirely different from the situation that we're faced with here. We're not trying to exploit the land registration process. We're actually trying to cleave to the land registration process that we have relied on for more than 70 years, and that in turn our co-appellees relied on when we conveyed land to them. Again, for more than 70 years, there's been no dispute. There's no mineral reservation. Even after application of Robinson, the state didn't seek to somehow amend the law to reopen original land court decrees in order to insert these interests. We've relied on the sanctity of title from land court, and the state hasn't offered us any reason, any case law, or any reason to back away from that.
Now, there's a reference in the land court findings in this case about that back in the 1930s proceeding, the state filed an answer, had claims, and then there was a settlement of some claims and a transfer of property to resolve the claims. There's a reference that none of the claims made back by the state are relevant to this appeal. But is the nature of the settlement and what was bargained and what was resolved in that proceeding, is that part of the record, or is that simply the land court's decision that we're referring to.
I hope I'm understanding your question correctly, but the state pled interest in easements, I believe, to get to roadways and also certain acreage that the state claimed. The state at that time, I mean, under the doctrine of res judicata, could have raised and maybe should have raised these alleged mineral reservations and also this flowage easement if, in fact, it had the right to claim it, but it didn't. Res judicata says if you've already been in one proceeding before a court of competent jurisdiction and either you litigated the issue or you should have and didn't litigate the issue, you can't bring it up again. And that's what's happening.
I guess my question is the nature of the settlement back in 38 or 37 where the court announced its decision, is that, are the details of that in the record?
I don't believe that they are, Your Honor, but if I may, with respect, I don't believe that the details would be relevant for the reasons I've already explained. When you look at what Chapter 501 stands for, the decree is the final order. The decrees are marching orders, and the decree wasn't appealed from. The only reason, again, why we're here today is not to reopen the decree. That's not possible. The only reason we're here today is because we were seeking to do a simple subdivision, and under the land court rules, and if I can, remember, land court is this very special body of law. Most of the land in the state isn't even under land court. Okay, why do people voluntarily submit to it? To get perfect or perfect assurance of title. Under land court rules, when property has experienced either erosion or accretion, so again, it's a subset of all property, it's land court registered property. A further subset has to be shoreline because there's erosion or accretion, and yet a further subset on that, it is, like I said, there has to be erosion or accretion. So if you have all of those elements present, only then can the state be a party. If we were in the regular system where we don't get this alleged, you know, sanctity of title, the state wouldn't have the ability to interfere with a subdivision action. The state wouldn't even know about it.
No, there's a reference that the original registration was for 15,000 acres.
Correct.
How big is the property at issue in this appeal?
The property at issue, there are two lots, if I may, just about 270 acres.
Say that again?
About 269 acres, 0.789. We created two lots out of that, 163-acre lot, a 72-acre lot, and then about 34 acres were lost due to erosion. There's no dispute on the erosion.
All right. And your brief, I think there's a reference to the fact that, and I think it's of the 15,000 acres, there have been multiple transfers and conveyances to various parties. Is that true also with respect to the 268 acres, or is with respect to the acres at issue in this appeal, we're really just talking about the 1938 registration and there's been not much changing of hands with respect to that property?
There has not been much changing of hands. James Campbell Company is the direct successor to the estate. However, as I believe was also mentioned in the pleadings, in 2006, James Campbell Company conveyed property to the parties who are now our co-appellees, and that was done in reliance. So from the beginning, yes, there was privity. The state, okay, it was a territory, now it's a state. It used to be the estate of James Campbell, now it's James Campbell Company, but basically the parties are the same. Where things got interfered with, and really what we're most concerned is because we made conveyances in reliance. If I may, too, I'd like to just quickly address another case that the state didn't discuss in argument today, but was raised in its brief, because I think it's sort of unusual that they pointed to it to support the contention that, in fact, they didn't need to claim a flowage easement, that it just exists sort of by operation of law. And that's the Triangle Center Incorporated versus Department of Public Works case, and that's a Massachusetts case, Supreme Court of Massachusetts, again, one of the few states in the country that's subject to the TORN system. What that case held specifically is that the Department of Public Works, any municipality, whoever it was, had a common law right to do a de minimis amount of drainage onto private property. That was a common law right. In fact, the court there said, that's not an easement or an encumbrance, that's a common law right. It cannot be put on the certificate of title because easements and encumbrances get put on certificates of title. It further said that if additional drainage onto the private property land was attributable to the roadway construction, that's why the state had gotten the, was doing the drainage, and if the maintenance of the road causes identifiable and more than de minimis damage, an injunction would be appropriate, leaving the municipality to make other drainage arrangements or to take, i.e. condemn, an easement. So that case, it frankly confounds me how it supports anything that the state has presented today. I think it entirely supports our position, which is A, drainage easement cannot be imposed without actually taking land. Any kind of common law right for some kind of ability to just drain, you know, to let water flow over property, that's simply a common law right. Or if the state chooses to frame it as a public trust right, that's fine. But public trust isn't a sword. Public trust can't be used to skewer the private property rights of landowners. Public trust is something to protect the interests of the public. We're part of the public. We're not opposed to the public trust. We don't deny that the state has public trust rights over our property, but we believe that the Land Court correctly found that those public trust rights don't constitute an easement or an encumbrance on title.
So how would the state effectively assert, say that the state's public trust rights were implicated with respect to the subject property, your property? How would the state, in the absence of an easement or a recorded interest on the property, how would the state go about asserting its rights?
Those rights are like the air we breathe. I mean, they're background principles of Hawaiian property law. They're there no matter what. The state no more has to assert those rights than I have the ability to say you can't assert those rights on this property. That stick was never in the bundle that James Campbell State got. Public trust has always been there.
So you can see that the presence or absence of a recorded easement on the title of the property has no impact on the state's possession or ability to exercise its water rights.
I do concede that point with the understanding that a flowage easement is something very different.
Yeah, well, what is a flowage? What is a easement for? Is there such a thing as an easement for free flowage of water? And if so, what is it?
Well, sure. Like the Triangle case in Massachusetts, you know, it's the ability to flood land, and that's an important right. I mean, imagine you're a farmer, and the guy next to you wants to flood your land. Well, it could benefit you. It could also really kill you. You know, it could kill your business. Imagine that you're a purchaser of property wanting to build a house, and all of a sudden you find out that the entire property is subject to this easement. At any time, an undisclosed amount of water could come rushing down. That's what an easement for the free flowage of water could provide. The case of Bremer versus Weeks, which is a 2004, maybe 2007 Hawaii Supreme Court case, cited restatement definition of what an easement is. An easement, quote, is an interest in land that's in the possession of another. So again, our bundle of sticks, an easement isn't you never received that stick in the first place. An easement is that's your bundle, I'm taking a stick away. Okay? It's the interest in land that I own. It entitles the easement holder to limited use or enjoyment of the land. There's a few other details, but the point I'd like to bring is the easement is capable of creation by conveyance. That means that there's got to be a grantor and a grantee. That means that there's got to be terms. That means that there's got to be some kind of defined scope of what that easement is. To this day, we have not heard what this flowage easement is meant to constitute, and are left to say, okay, the entire property could be subject to a flood at any time at the will of the state. Curiously, the state, the Rodriguez versus State of Hawaii 1970 case that council brought up a few minutes ago, actually says where the state may take precautions to protect its highways from the hazards of surface waters, it has a duty to prevent unnecessary harm to neighboring lands which may result from such precautions. So when I consider what is the impact, potential impact of this proposed flowage easement, and I also look at Rodriguez, I say, so is the state trying to avoid liability? They want to freely dump water all over our property and all of a sudden they're not liable? There's no nuisance, there's no liability? Certainly, not only does that completely completely turn the land court registration process totally on its head, but it also seriously interferes with everybody's understanding of private property rights. Again, public trust and private property rights, those things go together. There's no inconsistency. An imposition of an easement, the ability to come and invade my property at will, and private property rights, those are two entirely different things.
So your argument is, although there are, the state retains inherent water rights, those inherent water rights don't translate into a free flowage of water easement, which is apparently the state's argument, that because we have these rights, it necessarily means we also have the right to an easement for the free flowage of water over the property. You agree with the first part, but you don't agree that there is an automatic relationship between the existence of the right and the entitlement to the easement.
That's absolutely correct, and I would also say that the public trust with respect to water rights actually goes to where the water is. Okay, so if there's a stream running through my property, the public trust, you know, is attached to that. I can't get rid of it. There's no way to do that. You know, I'm along the ocean. I can't get rid of the public trust that's on that property. In contrast, an easement for a drainage easement or a flowage easement actually says, there's no water on your property, I've got the right to dump water on your property. There's no public trust, there's no case law, there's no public trust doctrine that could ever support that kind of analysis. If I may, too, just going to the mineral reservation, because the state has made a curious argument that of the four sources of title, three of which we all acknowledge it's not in dispute, did originally have that mineral reservation. The fourth source of title came directly from King Kamehameha III. Absolutely no language in the deed whatsoever indicating the reservation. Nevertheless, the state argues that the reservation of mineral metallic mines was somehow understood. The facts just simply don't support that analysis. First of all, that's my
5 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, first of all, the king did have perfect title. What was the exception to the king's perfect title? It was rights of native tenants. Those rights got brought in under the Kuleana Act. The concept was there prior to the Kuleana Act, but certainly by 1850, the Kuleana Act said rights of native tenants, and if you'd like, I can go into what they are, but there's absolutely not a breath about mineral reservations within the Kuleana Act. And I bring up the years for a specific reason. 1850, the Kuleana Act was enacted, and it was somewhat modified, but it's essentially found in HRS 7-1 right now. The language of the act that put in, quote, the form of all royal fee, simple patent shall be as follows, accepting and reserving to the Hawaiian government all mineral or metallic mines of every description. That was put into law in 1846. So in 1846, the king and all of his wise men said, we want this mineral and metallic mine reservation to be inserted into the grants that come from the government, 1846. 1850, the king and all of his wise men said, let's pass the Kuleana Act, make sure that we respect the rights of native tenants. They were well aware of the mineral and metallic mine reservation, yet they certainly never incorporated that into the Kuleana Act. So looking at those facts with the additional fact that the king's deed absolutely had no mention of any kind of reservation, I believe leads to the conclusion that the King Kamehameha III deed was subject to nothing more than the rights of native tenants.
Well, how do you characterize, what kind of property interest is the reservation of mineral metallic rights?
What kind of property interest?
Is it an encumbrance? Is it what is it?
Well, I mean, it's definitely an encumbrance. It's the bundle of sticks minus one. It's definitely encumbrance. It's not a public trust matter.
Is there any case that you're aware of in which that right or that interest was extinguished in a torrent system registration?
Well, we've already talked about the application of Robinson, where the land court did say it didn't apply. The state appealed, and the state was successful because they timely appealed and they said that they wanted it in there. I'm sorry, I can't think of any case right now, but I can say, and I believe the facts in the record show this, that the state's reservation of the mineral and metallic mines has been haphazard at best over the years, and that language, the 1846 reservation language, was in fact repealed just a few years later when they redid the civil code. In 1859, the civil code was amended to draft that reservation. So I know it's not directly responding to your question, but I hope it's demonstrating that the mineral metallic mine reservation was hardly this, you know, supreme sacrosanct kind of element in the sovereign. It kind of came and went, and the state, even in Robinson, admits that it's been something of questionable importance over the years. So with that, unless there are any further questions.
Thank you. How much time do they have left? 6 minutes? All right, you get one extra.
Good morning. Please support Jim Bickerton for James C. Reynolds Company, and also this morning, Mr. Iwao is president of court. He's kindly delegated to me the task of making the arguments on behalf of his client, Continental Pacific, as well, because we did file a joint brief. And I will be brief and limit my remarks unless the court has questions. The first thing I'd like to say in response to something that Chief Judge Nakamura said is there hasn't been a lot of trading back and forth of these particular parcels, but there has been one in particular trade that I think is significant, and that is that my client and Mr. Iwao's client are bona fide purchasers of the property. So we are not the original 1938 parties to the land court proceeding that resulted in the registration of this land. We took our title from the Campbell successor as bona fide purchasers, relying upon the land court decree. That's sort of the beauty of the land court decree, is you can do that. And that's definitely something I think the record shows. So in that respect, I don't think that the state's point carries much weight when they say, well, Campbell didn't argue this or Campbell didn't argue that. We certainly have the rights of a bona fide purchaser, and the statute does talk about that and does give some weight to that, recognizing, of course, that we can only take what Campbell could convey. I think that in reading the state's reply, I view oral argument as an opportunity to really talk about the reply brief, because that's something we didn't respond to the writing. And looking at it carefully, it struck me that there was a very cavalier or loose approach to what the word easement means. They assert repeatedly that they have these constitutional duties and trust obligations and so forth, and the various rights that the state may have. And they say, and therefore we get an easement. And it's that last jump that I have trouble with, because I didn't see anywhere in their papers any authority for saying it's an easement. I think it requires us to look at what an easement is. And the best thing I can give you is that if it's a law of general application, then it applies across the board to everybody. By definition, an easement is something unique to that property. If it's something that is the same for everybody, then it can't be an easement. An easement is supposed to be tied to the land and run with the land. There's an interesting remark that they make at page 23 of their opening brief that bears upon that. They say, thus, the state's reservation of an easement for the free flowage of water, both over and under the property, is not factually dependent on what can be seen on the land. To me, that's almost a direct admission that it's not an easement. It doesn't have anything to do with this particular property, with the contours, where the swales are, where the natural water courses are. It's a hypothetical, abstract principle that they claim for all land, and that's not the nature of an easement. I think this also bears upon the question of whether there's been manifest injustice. If they have these rights at law as a general incident of law, and the land court statute specifically says that even land court property is subject to general laws and the burdens and incidents of general law, then where is the manifest injustice in not recording an easement over and above the general rights that they have? I think what they're really doing here is asking for an advisory opinion. When you come before the court, you say, I can't point to any specific facts, and nothing has come up about this, but I want you to declare this and put this down. That's really an advisory opinion, and I think a question Chief Judge Nakamura posed was, well, you know, how do they enforce this right? How does it come up? Where is it? If they don't have an easement written down, how does it happen? The way it happens is someone has to do something contrary to the general law. Someone has to interfere with the state's public trust, actively do something. Then the state can come in and say, hey, we have this general right under general law. You can't do that. Then you have a case or controversy, and the court then applies the state constitution and vast body of complicated law, which I'm certainly not going to recap here and couldn't if I tried because it's very complex. But at that point, you apply and decide, can this person do this or not? The state is protected by that system of laws. One last point I would make is in just looking at Article 11, Section 7 of the state constitution, it talks about this issue somewhat because when it talks about the state's obligation to protect, control, and regulate the use of Hawaii's water resources, which I understand is the state's claimed basis for the position they take, it goes on to say in that very same provision, while assuring appurtenant rights and existing correlative and riparian uses and establishing procedures for regulating all uses. That's the one that talks about the creation of the Water Commission. There are mechanisms for sorting these things out and figuring out who does what, but not in an abstract, across-the-board, one-size-fits-all declaration that you get an easement. And it isn't going to be one-size-fits-all because it's only going to affect, as they say, cases that come up from time to time for subdivision or some other kind of proceeding where the state can jump in and have this patchwork of properties, some of which have a recorded easement and some of which don't, but according to the state, all have the same.
Votto.
Yeah, it's hard to be sure. Quickly, Your Honor, one quick comment about Juliana rights, and then I will talk about the free flow of water. Regarding the Kuleana rights, they were derived from the rights of the chiefs, and the chiefs did not have mineral rights when they were granted their lands during the Mahele. Now, as far as the free flowage of water goes, the state is not asserting any right to go and dump water all over private land. We're asking for an easement for the free flowage of water to be able to ensure the flow of water over the water courses over and under the land. Now, if the court finds that no actual easement is required, we would ask that the court acknowledge that the water right must include free flowage. We would ask that you clarify that, because we think that that is part and parcel of the water rights that the state has.
You mean it's not clear enough generally? I mean, are you arguing it?
I think in what the land court granted in this case, the language that they used, it was not clear. They put in a lot of qualifiers, the state's water right, if any. And finally, in the Koestler case, the one that I quoted from Minnesota, yes, the neighbor was served with the land court application, and it did identify the land that was to be registered, unlike our case where the mineral metallic mines were not identified. So I'd like to make that distinction. And unless the court has any other questions.
No?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll take the case under advisement.